It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jake Carlisle-Larson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin's dairy industry relies heavily on immigrant labor. A new report from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism looks at the history behind Wisconsin's immigrant workforce.
First, a new report from the Washington Post and 60 Minutes takes a hard look at a bill that was passed in April of 2016 that effectively stripped the Drug Enforcement Agency, or DEA, of its power to go after prescription drug distributors.
The report says that a handful of congresspeople worked with some of the nation's biggest prescription drug lobbyists to persuade the DEA and the Justice Department to agree to a more industry-friendly law. These efforts came during the height of the opioid epidemic. Here's a clip from a Washington Post video featuring Joseph Ranazizi, who formerly ran the DEA's division responsible for regulating the drug industry.
It watered down DEA's authority to go after wholesalers, manufacturers, distributors, and it weakened their authority to go after pharmacies.
Our next guest says the story is just one part of the wider problem of opioid addiction. Dr. Caleb Alexander is the co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Drug Safety and Effectiveness. Dr. Alexander, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, there's a lot of parts to the story of the opioid epidemic, but what do you make of this particular report on this bill, the Ensuring Patient Access and Effective Drug Enforcement Act, related to the distributors of pharmaceuticals?
Well, I think many people have found it quite shocking, frankly, and I think many people weren't aware of the nature of the bill or the way that it undermined one of the Drug Enforcement Agency's key functions, which is to conduct surveillance of drug wholesalers that are moving pharmaceutical products from manufacturers to pharmacies and to intervene when they see suspicious activity. And I think that a lot of people have expressed concern since this report came out about the ways that this may really hobble the DEA's function.
Now, these are prescription drugs, opioid medications. What was going on here was some pharmacies, some suppliers were getting a lot of these medications through these distributors. The DEA wanted the distributors to help figure out who was getting too many drugs, look at suspicious activity. How important a part of the overall story of opioid drugs was this one angle?
Well, it's a really important one. You know, I think that there is a small proportion of prescribers and of pharmacies that account for a large proportion of opioids in circulation. And I wouldn't want for listeners to think that the opioid epidemic is just a problem of pill mills and what are called rogue prescribers, that is, prescribers that are practicing way outside of the you know, normal practice of medicine. But there are prescribers like that, and there are pill mills. These are typically settings where prescribers may be seeing up to 100 or 200 patients per day, often prescribing medicines without doing physical exams, without keeping proper records, and clearly violating the best standards of clinical care. So it is vital that the DEA have the opportunity to and the enforcement ability to go after these pill mills and rogue prescribers when they are identified.
Big picture, this opioid epidemic has been building a long time. Where are we right now? Are we still on the rise? Are things still getting worse in the country?
Well, I wish I had better news for you. This is an epidemic that's been really hidden in plain sight for 2 decades. And incredibly, more people died in 2015 than ever before. And the CDC has come out with preliminary estimates for 2016, and they're worse yet. So an estimated 64,000 Americans succumbing from drug overdoses. Prescription opioids are just one part of that. And many people are also dying from heroin and illicit fentanyl. So incredibly, despite the widespread attention that the epidemic rightly gets and deserves, the estimates are that more people will die in 2017 than in 2016. It's a massive problem, and it's a very complex problem. And so it will take a while to really turn this steamship around.
We're talking to Dr. Caleb Alexander from the Johns Hopkins Center for Drug Safety and Effectiveness, looking at the opioid epidemic after a Washington Post 60 Minutes expose that came out last night. As you say, it's a complicated problem, Dr. Alexander, and you point toward a number of different stakeholders, each of whom can take an action that can help. Let's start with the drug manufacturers themselves. What could be their contribution to solving the problem?
Well, I think that many people point to manufacturers because, indeed, in the late 1990s and early 2000s, opioids were marketed and promoted for the treatment of chronic non-cancer pain, things like lower back pain, fibromyalgia, chronic headaches. And unfortunately, what we've learned the hard way is that the evidence supporting the use of opioids in this setting is really thin. That is, we've tended to overestimate the effectiveness of opioids for these types of pain and also underestimate their risks. So I think that one of the important things that the manufacturers can do in concert with the FDA is to pull back on advertising that markets and promotes opioids for the treatment of non-cancer pain, where so many injuries and deaths have occurred.
Let's take it to the doctors now. They're the ones in the room with the patient, maybe a patient who's suffering and in pain and wants the medication either for the pain or for their addiction, in effect, to avoid the withdrawal symptoms. What can doctors do to help with this?
Well, I think there are two different issues here. So the first is that the treatment of chronic pain, and there are lots and lots of tools in the toolbox. I'm a general internist, and like so many doctors, I think that we've tended to reach for opioids far too early. And when I was in training in the late 1990s, I can remember having been taught that if a patient had what was called at the time true pain or legitimate pain, quote unquote, that one need not have to worry about the addictive potential of opioids. And nothing could be further from the truth. And unfortunately, I was part of a whole generation of professionals that was taught as such. So I think the first thing that healthcare professionals need to keep in mind is that there are many tools in the toolbox and that there are many alternative prescription drugs as well as many non-drug therapies that can be used. But the second part of your question had to do with patients that may have an opioid use disorder, that is, who may have addiction. And unfortunately, more than 2 million Americans are estimated to have an opioid use disorder. And the majority of these haven't been diagnosed. That is, they and their providers haven't identified that they are addicted to opioids or have an opioid use disorder. So I think it's imperative that prescribers and patients improve screening to identify these patients and connect them with treatment, because we know that there is evidence-based treatment out there and that people lead very rewarding, successful lives in recovery after having experienced opioid addiction.
What's the state of insurance coverage for different types of pain treatment?
Well, it's a great question. I think deservedly there's a brighter and brighter light that's shining on insurance coverage. And the reason why is because if these types of treatments, that is alternatives to opioids, aren't covered well by insurance, people aren't going to use them. So understandably, these days, everyone is focused on opioids, and rightly so, because so many people are getting injured or dying or developing addiction from long-term use of opioids. But while we're doing so, we also need to remember that the coverage and reimbursement policies for alternatives to opioids make a big difference in ultimately the care that people will seek.
What are some of the alternatives to opioids? What can a doctor reach for in their toolkit instead of that prescription?
Well, incredibly, the first most oftentimes the first best thing to reach for are treatments that are over the counter. So I have dozens of patients that come to me with musculoskeletal pain, most commonly lower back pain, but also hip arthritis or knee arthritis, sometimes other types of chronic non-cancer pain, who are well controlled with non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, or sometimes we call those NSAIDs, things like ibuprofen or naproxen. Acetaminophen or Tylenol also works very well for many patients. But there are many other prescription medicines that can be used as well, not just over-the-counter, but prescription medicines that we can use for different types of pain. So, for example, some antidepressants are also effective for treating what's called neuropathic pain, pain that's caused by a problem with the nerves. So, for example, patients with diabetes that may have what's called diabetic neuropathy can be treated successfully with these types of medicines.
a reaction sometimes from people, I think, who might have chronic pain would be, you're telling me I need an antidepressant means you're telling me my pain is all in my head. It's fake pain.
Well, yeah, nothing could be further from the truth. And there's no question that there may be some stigma associated with the use of, for example, an antidepressant. But these are medicines that have been studied rigorously and where there's good scientific evidence that they're effective in treating the type of pain that I'm talking about, neuropathic pain, for example. I think one really important message for people to understand is that there's no conflict between our reducing or overuse of prescription opioids and improving the quality of care for people in pain. I think sometimes people tend to think that there's a necessary loss here. That is, there's no winning solution. Either you peel back the opioids and then patients suffer, or you continue opioids and then there's a risk of overdose. And the answer is, these two are not in conflict in many, many cases. So I think there are a lot of opportunities for us to improve quality of care, all the while reducing our over-reliance on prescription opioids.
We're talking to Dr. Caleb Alexander from the Johns Hopkins Center for Drug Safety and Effectiveness. We're looking at the opioid epidemic in the United States after a Washington Post 60 Minutes report showed the ties between Congress and drug distributors and their lobbyists.
And you can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. How has the opioid epidemic touched your life? What's your take on this new report? And what do you think should be done to address this nationwide crisis? Call in now at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, get to your calls in just a few moments here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle-Larson. We're picking up our discussion now with Dr. Caleb Alexander from the Johns Hopkins Center for Drug Safety and Effectiveness. We're looking at the opioid epidemic after a new report shows Congress weakened the DEA's ability to go after drug distributors.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this story part of your life? Has someone close to you become addicted to opioids? How has this crisis affected your life, your community, your practice, if you're in healthcare yourself? What should we do about it as a nation, as a medical system, as patients, parents, neighbors? What's your reaction to the latest news? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now with Steve in Plainfield. Steve, we just lost Steve. We'll get to other callers in just a bit at 800-642-1234. Dr. Alexander, I wanted to talk a little bit about addiction treatment. We hear about methadone and other medications that help people deal with symptoms of withdrawal. And we hear sometimes, including from the 12-step movement, you're just replacing one addiction with another. Can you speak to that issue?
Yeah, well, there's no question that addiction is a brain disease, and we know that treatments such as methadone and buprenorphine are effective when they're administered to patients. They improve the ability of patients to resume healthy, rewarding, productive lives and integrate within their communities, and they also, importantly, decrease the risk of overdose death. So, I don't think many addiction experts would argue against someone also using other approaches, and there are patients that successfully pursue 12-step programs or other programs, but I think the most important message is that treatments such as buprenorphine or methadone are evidence-based, and they have remarkable success rates in terms of allowing for people to live healthy, fulfilling lives in recovery.
We'll go to our callers now. Jamie is with us in Green Bay. Jamie, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about, Jamie?
So I just wanted to mention my experience with the use of opioids and morphines. I currently have 16 months sober, and it was a long road to recovery, but now I found that I cannot handle pain, and I avoid situations where I would be introduced to pain.
Are you worried, Jamie, that pain would be an incentive to go back to using a drug?
Right, exactly. And yeah, I'm not sure of any alternatives to that.
Well, this is something that I think is not uncommon. And, Jamie, thank you for sharing your experience. And many, many patients living in recovery struggle with that question. You know, for example, if they were to undergo surgery or experience some medical illness that caused pain, how would that optimally be managed? And the good news is that I think that healthcare professionals are increasingly aware of and trained to help manage pain in ways that avoid the need for opioids. So, you know, I think that the most important thing that I hear from your story is your willingness, you're having made a diagnosis, if you will, and you're having built up some time and living in recovery. And so I think, unfortunately, the majority of patients with opioid use disorders are still out there and haven't done so yet. So thank you for sharing your experience.
Jamie, thanks. Congratulations on 16 months and good luck down the road, too. We'll go next to Jason in Fort Atkinson. Jason, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to share. In 2009, I had back surgery. The only reason I was able to have back surgery is because I was going to a methadone clinic. Without the methadone clinic, I don't know where I would be today. And there aren't a lot of them. I think that if we want to solve this, you know, opioid addiction with everybody, we need to give people more opportunities to get better.
Jason, thank you so much. Good luck to you as well, Jason. And Dr. Alexander, and we hear in Wisconsin, there are no methadone clinics. I think this is still true in the northern half of the state. This is a pretty big state. What do you think about access to methadone and the other treatments like that?
Well, it's a huge issue, and I suppose the silver lining here is that there is bipartisan support for expanding access and the quality of care that's delivered within recovery services. And so I expect continued emphasis on this, and I think the more that state and federal lawmakers and policymakers can be aware of stories such as those that we've heard, the better off we'll be with respect to the investments being made that we need to be sure are made to shore up our treatment system.
Thanks for the call, Jason. We're talking to Dr. Caleb Alexander from the Johns Hopkins Center for Drug Safety and Effectiveness, looking at the opioid epidemic in the United States. Back to your calls now. Travis is on the line in Edgerton. Travis, hi.
Hi. So in the past 5 years, I've known more than a handful of people who have overdosed and passed away from heroin overdoses. I had one friend who we were trying to help. He was struggling with a heroin addiction. He came and stayed at our house for a while, and he was going through pretty severe withdrawals. He was unemployed and uninsured. We tried to help him find treatment through healthcare systems, and we found it really difficult to find a place that would take him without health insurance. I think it seems like it's really hard for people who want help and need help to get out there and like find treatment at low or no cost.
Thank you for sharing, and I'm sorry for your losses, Travis. And unfortunately, your experience is not that uncommon. And it's all the more reason that we need greater investments made in the treatment system and in shoring up the treatment system. You know, to be living with an opioid use disorder, as you know, having seen your friends, some of your friends, is difficult enough without the challenges that there are identifying high quality treatment services. And so, once again, I think the more that state policymakers, for example, in Wisconsin, are aware of this issue, the more they can go to bat and be sure for local communities that communities are being well served.
Travis, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Scott on the line in Whitewater. Scott, hi.
Yes, I just wanted to say there is a silver lining to this crisis, and it's the fact that it's hitting white upper class citizens. Before this issue, it's been going on for decades. When it was black and brown people, it was a criminal enterprise, and it was treated as criminals. instead of having sick people that need help, we had crackheads. And I think that this country is finally going to move forward and seeing the general public seeing addiction as an illness and a sickness as far, and instead of being a crime.
Scott, thanks for the call. Dr. Alexander, are you seeing a change in the way we think of addiction in our society, maybe just because it's hitting a wider group of people now?
Well, I mean, there's still, unfortunately, so much stigma associated with addiction, and it is unfortunate. You know, I'm often asked about specific subgroups, racial, demographic, different sexes or ages that are affected by this epidemic. And while it's true that the greatest mortality rate, the greatest overdose rate has been among middle-aged whites, there's not a group in the country that hasn't been touched or one way or another by the epidemic, and that's one of the reasons that it's such a bipartisan issue. So I think it's thanks to programs such as yours and the conversations that I hope more and more Americans will have around the dinner table and within their churches and religious organizations and communities that some of the stigma can be combated and that people will recognize addiction is a brain disease. It's treatable, but it's also preventable. And primary prevention means that we need to reduce the use of prescription opioids for chronic non-cancer pain.
Dr. Alexander, before we wrap up, just briefly, you started us off with some bad news about the trends, the overdose numbers, the addiction numbers. Are you hopeful that maybe in a few years we might start to see that curve move the other way?
I am. And, you know, if you think about motor vehicle deaths during, you know, 50 or 60 years ago, there were astronomically high rates of injuries and deaths from motor vehicle accidents. And over the course of a century, we underwent a remarkable transformation where cars, vehicle safety is now incredibly high, even though, of course, accidents still occur. I think that we will turn the steamship around, but it's going to take a while. This has been 20 years or more in the making, and I think it's going to take us many more years until we get back to, you know, the rates of injury or death, which were still far too high, but much lower than the current period.
Thanks to Dr. Caleb Alexander, co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Drug Safety and Effectiveness. You can find more about Wisconsin's opioid epidemic at wiscontext.org.
Coming up after the news, we look at how and why Wisconsin's dairy industry is so reliant on immigrant labor.
This is Central Time. Right now, Wisconsin's agricultural sector has relied on immigrant labor for years. With an overhaul of the nation's immigration policies and laws a priority for the current administration, there's been some concern over the impact changes could have on the country's workforce.
Here in Wisconsin, the dairy industry in particular depends on immigrant labor. The Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism recently reported on that relationship. Dee Hall is a co-founder of the center and serves as the managing editor. Dee, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks a lot for having me.
So how significant are immigrants working in the dairy industry? First, let's look at it nationally.
Well, nationally, it's a huge part of the dairy industry. There was an industry-sponsored study back in 2015, and it found that 79% of the milk that's produced is produced from farms that use immigrant labor.
And now looking at home, what is it like in Wisconsin?
It's also a significant factor here. We don't have current numbers right now for the proportion of dairy workers who are immigrants, but from everything that we have found out there talking to farmers, the fact that we have switched, we have graduated from smaller farms to much larger farms, that the need for workers is higher. And in fact, our hired workers, the number of people hired on the farm, is more than double just over the past 10 years. And that is one sign that these are likely immigrants is the fact that, you know, just the anecdotal information mm-hmm. we have from both farmers and workers that the vast majority of those workers are, in fact, immigrants.
And immigration has been a topic that has been coming up a lot, certainly over the last 8 years during the Obama administration, but also now under the Trump administration. Was immigration ever anything that
was factored in to, you know, for dairy farmers? Was this a topic of conversation, something that they were even considering?
Not that much until about the year 2000. So I quoted a researcher who was here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and she and some of her fellow researchers really tracked the emergence of the immigrant dairy worker in Wisconsin, and they kind of pinned it back to about the year 2000. It was about that time when there was a lot of restructuring going on in the dairy industry. Farms were getting larger and larger. Some of the smaller farms were going away. And at that time, farmers were looking around and realizing they were not able to get local people to work at the farms. The farms that had generated, the family farms that had generated workers for their own farms, they were going away. Of course, then on top of that, we have basically a rural depopulation that mm-hmm. happens starting before 2000, but we documented it in a previous story. From 2000 to 2010, the state as a whole grew at 6%, but about a quarter of about one-fifth to one-fourth of the counties actually lost population during that same time. And that's pretty robust growth. They lost people, and they lost a lot of young people. And so that has that has really contributed to an overall rural labor shortage.
Yeah, so it seems, you know, with the sort of decline of the small to medium-sized family farm mixed with rural population loss, that this was kind of the perfect storm for both the industry, which has had such a foothold in Wisconsin since its founding, to now. With the latest report, you had said that there's some anecdotal stories. What did you find? How did you set out on this story?
Well, we've been covering this issue for quite a lot this year, primarily. Well, we began covering it in 2009. We did a big series of stories back in 2009 at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. And then we decided to revisit it now because of the rhetoric coming out of Washington and the actions coming out of Washington mm-hmm. to try to reduce the flow of immigration, because we knew that for this sector, we're the number two in the nation in terms of dairy milk production and number one for cheese. And this is a big industry for us. And we are a big part of the industry nationally. And we knew that even back in the earlier 2000s, that there was a heavy reliance on these immigrants, and that has just accelerated, frankly. So that's why we got into it.
I want to get to one of the stories that you told in this overall piece. You spoke with a few farmers, one of whom was Tim Keller from Mount Horeb, who said not only can he not find local labor, but if it really came down to it, he would prefer to work with an immigrant. Can you talk a little bit about what his story is?
Both Keller and the farm that we sort of set the story at, the Rip Farm, mm-hmm. which is in the village of Dane, both the operators of those two farms had a very similar story, which is that they have tried for a long time to get local people to work on the farm. The hours are long. You're out in all kinds of weather, from really hot to really cold to rainy. It can be dirty. It can be dangerous. There are long hours involved. And what they found is that U.S.-born workers are really not that interested, at least with the wages that they pay. And so, yes, he said, Keller said, I'd rather have a Latino, because he feels like they have been more flexible, willing to work longer hours, partly because it's kind of a matter of perspective. If you're raised in a country where there are very, very few opportunities and you're given this opportunity, this seems like a golden opportunity. If you're in a place where you can't really support your family, these wages, although some people might consider them low, are very reasonable. And when you come from a country like Mexico, where you have very few opportunities, and when you do work, you don't really get paid that much. So what we found was essentially a similar story across the state. We've heard this from farmers in northeastern Wisconsin, northwestern Wisconsin, central and south central Wisconsin, and they're all saying sort of the same thing.
We're talking to Dee Hall right now. She is a co-founder of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism and serves as the managing editor. And she's with us right now to talk about the role that immigrants play in Wisconsin's dairy industry. And sticking with that conversation about American-born workers not thinking the wages are high enough, and then, you know, these external factors leading immigrants to come to Wisconsin, what is the labor aspect of that? What are labor activists saying about this?
So we did interview a man who's a longtime labor activist, and his feeling is that if the industry were to raise wages, that there would be a break point at which U.S.-born workers would come in. And there's a fear, he believes, that by hiring immigrants in such large proportions that we're unnaturally driving down both the pay and the benefits that people in this field earn. So that's sort of an untested theory. We don't really know because no one has tried to raise wages very, very high above the market rate. Right now, a place like the Rip Farm is paying like $11.50 to $12 an hour as a beginning wage. They also provide housing, which, of course, has some value. And, you know, there's opportunity for that wage to go up to $15 an hour or something in that category. So for some Americans, they would perhaps think that's too low. But again, it depends on where you come from and what your other options are. And for these workers, some of whom are very, very skilled in dairy work, they did that in their home country. This is a good opportunity.
And milk is treated as a commodity. It is regulated at the federal level. At what point is federal policy affecting this as well?
Well, the milk pricing system would take hours to even try to understand.
Sure.
And I'm not even going to pretend that I do understand it, except I do know one thing. The farmers really don't control it.
Mm-hmm.
And so their argument is, you know, we could pay our workers whatever we pay them, but the price of milk can go up, but it can also go down pretty drastically in a pretty short period of time. And we could be really trapped in a cycle, because again, it's hard to scale back when you're on a dairy farm. You have to milk a cow three times a day now, and you can't just sort of like lay off workers. These cows, they don't, as I think somebody in our story said, they don't take a break. The mm-hmm. cows don't take a break. They need to be milked three times a day, and so it's not that flexible. Other businesses can maybe lay people off and then hire them when things get better or prices go up. These farms are really at the mercy of whatever the price is that's set. And what they're saying is, given the current setup, given our overall national cheap food policy, that paying a bunch more money is not reasonable. Whether that is true or not, I don't know. Just as I don't know the flip side, if you were to pay a bunch, would a bunch of U.S.-born workers flood into the industry?
Sure. With the conversation about immigration reform happening now in Washington, obviously President Trump is in office now, and he campaigned on a pretty strong line on immigration into the country. Are dairy farmers worried in Wisconsin?
I think, yeah, they're definitely worried. Many of them voted for Trump because farmers tend to be conservative. But I found it interesting that our just retired agriculture secretary also favors changes that would legalize and normalize the work of these immigrant dairy workers, because right now we don't have a legal way for them to be here year-round milking the cows.
Dee, thank you so much for being with us today.
All right, thanks a lot.
Dee Hall is a co-founder of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism and serves as the managing editor. She joined us to talk about a recent report from the center about how Wisconsin's dairy industry came to be so reliant on immigrant labor. First, our next guest is a former federal prosecutor who says at one point in his career he didn't think innocent people were sent to prison in this country.
But while teaching a law class in 2001, he was asked to supervise the Kentucky Innocence Project, which led to an epiphany of sorts.
When his students uncovered DNA evidence that led to the reversal of a conviction, he took another look at the way crime investigations and prosecutions can put the wrong people behind bars.
Mark Godsey is a professor of law at the University of Cincinnati and the author of the new book, Blind Injustice: A Former Prosecutor Exposes the Psychology and Politics of Wrongful Convictions. He's also the director of the Ohio Innocence Project. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, you were a former federal prosecutor. Tell us about this case that started to change your mind.
Yeah, well, I mean, I came into the job, you know, a prosecutor's prosecutor. I'd been tough on crime. I'd been award-winning. You know, I was a prosecutor in New York City. And just had that mentality and was very actually proud of it, being very tough on crime and all that kind of stuff. And so I went to a different school that had an innocence project already in existence. The professor who ran it was on sabbatical, so they asked me to supervise, and I really couldn't say no as the new professor on the block. And I remember going into the first meeting with the students, and they were going on and on about this prisoner that they thought was innocent named Herman May. And I asked about the case, and they told me how he got convicted. And I just sort of did a big eye roll and was just like, oh, yeah, right, this guy's totally guilty, and sort of wrote them off as these bleeding heart law students. And then DNA came back, and proved him innocent. He was released. And, you know, just a few weeks earlier, I'd been scoffing at the stories of how he was a high school senior and the police had come and yanked him out of his social studies class, taken him down to the police station and plucked pubic hairs from his groin. And he stayed in the jail cell throwing up all night. You know, I'd just been like, yeah, he deserved it. And 'cause he's a rapist, but I was wrong. And so I sort of went through this, starting with that, this conversion where I sort of made it my business to try to understand how this happened. And then ultimately founded my own Innocence Project in Ohio. We've now freed 25 people who together served 470 years in prison for crimes they didn't commit. So I thought, you know, the transition I went through helps me understand the mentality of the prosecutors and how this happens. And so I wanted to write about it.
And let's get into that mentality. You say in many cases, maybe most cases of wrongful conviction, it wasn't that there was a bad actor operating in bad faith, whether a prosecutor or a police officer, but there are a lot of psychological assumptions and mindsets involved. Can you talk about kind of the baseline of that mindset that says, I know who's guilty, now we're going to prove it?
Yeah, I'll start off by talking about how they react in these post-conviction cases. And that was the first thing. Once I started doing innocence work, you know, we had several cases where the DNA clearly proved the person innocent. And we went to court and the prosecutors like fought back, you know, and I sort of thought, well, the evidence is clear. They're going to let the guy go. And they would come up with these ridiculous theories that just didn't make any sense and argue them with passion to try to say the guy's still guilty. And, you know, I talk about that in chapter two, and it's really just a form of denial. I mean, I think it's not that, you know, there's an evil person saying I'm going to keep an innocent person in prison, but most of these prosecutors and police are going into this for the right reasons, and it's part of their psyche and identity that they're the good guys and they're protecting society. And it's very hard after, you know, 20 years for somebody to come back and say, you ruined somebody's life and you put an innocent person in prison. It's just sort of human nature. Cognitive dissonance kicks in. I talk about that quite a bit. Administrative evil, where you're sort of, that's a phenomenon where you're in a bureaucracy and you're just sort of going through the motions. And after a while, you're just following the routines of the organization. You don't really check your morality in the same way that you would if you were acting alone. So all these sort of things combine to sort of blind people. That's why I call it blind injustice, where they just start going through the motions instead of like looking at the humanity of each case. And so, that, you know, that plays out in actual prosecutions now. I mean, prosecutors and police dehumanize the people that are charged. You know, they look at them as sort of deserving, as I did. They don't really stop and think about each case on an individual basis. It becomes very cookie cutter and like an assembly line approach to these cases. You know, there's a lot of the judges and prosecutors in most states are elected, so it becomes very politicized, where everyone has to sort of be tough on crime and flex their muscles and show everybody else in the office how tough they are on crime if they want to, you know, rise up in the ranks. And so it becomes very difficult internally from an institutional level to be sort of a reasonable person who steps back and wants to show sympathy to criminal defendants sometimes. So that's part of it. But, you know, there's confirmation bias and tunnel vision. There's malleable memories. There's all sorts of different psychological phenomena that could lead to these wrongful convictions. And many of the time, the prosecutors aren't aware of it.
Let's get into a couple of specifics you just mentioned, and memory is one of those. You write a lot about witness identification, which as a layperson seems pretty convincing. Oh, one person, the victim, or three eyewitnesses or whatever, were successfully able to identify this person as the criminal, which often has happened in cases where we later found out, maybe because of DNA, that it wasn't them at all. What goes wrong with eyewitness identifications?
Yeah, I mean, it used to be the case, and I mean, to some degree, still maybe today, that if a witness takes a stand and says, I saw the crime happen, you know, I was the victim, I got a good look at the person's face, and I'm 100% certain that that's the guy who did it, and points at the defendant in the chair, that everyone sort of thinks, well, wow, you know, how could they possibly be wrong? That person's really confident. They would know they were there, and that's sort of the end of the case. Because of all these wrongful convictions and how they've been studied, you know, we've identified more than 2,000 in the past 25 years. We know that mistaken eyewitness identification is the leading cause of wrongful conviction, and it's caused sort of renewed interest in studying human memory. And I talk about this in Chapter 5 of Blind Injustice. It's fascinating when you really get into it how we have such a misconception in the public about human memory. In reality, our human memories, you know, many think of them as like a hard drive or a video recorder, and sort of you take down what you see and hear, and then later you hit the play button, you play it back. But in reality, our memories are more like quicksand. I mean, they're constantly sort of changing and shifting underneath us. They're much like Wikipedia, where we edit them and other people can edit them. And we're not even aware when, you know, somebody through suggestion, like a police officer, has asked some pointed questions that sort of change what we might think. And then all of a sudden our memory changes. And so it's a really fascinating thing to explore, as I do in Chapter 5. And, you know, I talk about how when I was a prosecutor, we played on that all the time. I mean, you'd have a case where you're convinced that the murder happened or the crime happened at 11 o'clock at night, and a witness comes in and says, well, he was still in the bar. The defendant was still in the bar at 11 o'clock. And what happens? Well, the police and the prosecutors sort of start cross-examining him there in the interview room and saying, are you sure? Because, you know, other witnesses are telling us different and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And, like, you sort of test their memory, and it's not uncommon that you sort of bend a witness. They'll end up changing. You know, the more I think about it, you know, I think the game was still on. And by the time that person testifies at trial, they may fully believe what we call is now synthesized testimony. It's been sort of altered by the questioning of the police and prosecutors. And they may firmly believe the altered testimony, but that's not what they originally said. And it's more troubling, as what happened in my office, when sometimes the prosecutors and the police don't write down the original statement. When a witness gives information that's helpful to the defendant, like, you know, he was in the bar at the time of the murder, that's very helpful. They're supposed to write that down and turn it over. It's called Brady material after a U.S. Supreme Court case. They're supposed to give it to the defense pre-trial, so the defense is aware of it. But that doesn't always happen, unfortunately.
We're talking to Mark Godsey, author of the new book, Blind Injustice, A Former Prosecutor Exposes the Psychology and Politics of Wrongful Convictions. Let's talk a little bit about forensic evidence, Mark. I think for a generation raised on CSI and other shows, we're really convinced by what looks like objective scientific evidence that connects a suspect to a crime. Where can that go wrong?
Yeah, there's such a disconnect there because of all these CSI shows where, you know, the public thinks this forensic science stuff is akin to putting man on the moon. You know, it's these miracles that are happening. And in reality, we've got serious problems with forensics in this country. They're often unreliable. They're often overstated by forensic experts in court. And it is also, you know, bad forensic testimony is also a leading cause of wrongful conviction. You know, it's a couple of different things going on. Many of these forensic disciplines have never been sort of vetted under the scientific method. So they're themselves just sort of unreliable. You know, I've got a case where the person who committed the murder used a crowbar to break open a cigarette machine. Remember how cigarette machines used to always be in bars and they would be full of quarters? And back when this crime happened, after they murdered the people in the bar, the perpetrator broke open the cigarette machine with a crowbar. And he was convicted because the forensic expert testified that the crowbar found in the defendant's house, to the exclusion of every other crowbar in the world, is the one that made the scratches on the cigarette machine. But there's actually no sort of method by which you can say that. I mean, it's a great exaggeration. That's a perfect example. There's also some really interesting psychological studies going on about the extent to which confirmation bias taints outcomes. I mean, there's a guy named N.T.L. Dror, a psychologist out of London, who did an experiment where he went to some of the leading experts, fingerprint experts in the world, and said, you know, I want you to do something for me. We've got a case where a fingerprint expert testified years ago that the defendant's fingerprint was found at the crime scene, and that caused him to get convicted. But we now know from DNA evidence that the guy's innocent, so the fingerprint expert made a mistake. What we want you to do is look at the two fingerprints that was called a match at trial many years ago and tell us where this forensic expert went wrong. Tell us where the discrepancies are between the two fingerprints. What each fingerprint expert didn't know is that they were actually given a fingerprint set from their own case files that they had called a match in court years before. So they thought they were looking at one where it was a known mistake, but it was actually one where they caused somebody to get convicted. But this time they're told beforehand not to expect a match, and N.T.L. Dror got 80% of the fingerprint experts to flip their answer and say, yeah, there's not a match here. These are not the same.
And we'll leave it there. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you very much.
That's Mark Godsey. His new book is called Blind Justice, A Former Prosecutor Exposes the Psychology and Politics of Wrongful Convictions. He's a law professor at the University of Cincinnati and the director of the Ohio Innocence Project. You can share your thoughts and experiences. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or send us a message on the Ideas Network Facebook page. That's Hanson with Mbop. This year is the 20th anniversary of their breakthrough album, Middle of Nowhere.
And the three brothers are still together as a band, and they performed in NPR's Tiny Desk concert, and that performance went online today.
And JC, I understand that Hanson holds a special place in your heart.
I'm not entirely sure I'll say special
it's
place
very,
in my
very
heart,
special.
But what I will say is that it was the first CD that my parents ever let me have, and they gave it to me, and I remember being very pleased that they trusted me with a CD finally. but it always still feels weird as an adult, since that was not their style of music in the slightest. My mom was super into like Nirvana and Pearl Jam, so I'm surprised that they were like, all right, you can listen to this in our house.
So that was Hanson was your act of rebellion.
I think my musical rebellions were a little bit harder core than Hanson, but I did re-listen to some of Middle of Nowhere today and was terrified to find out that I remembered most of the words. So,
well, you can get a little taste of what they sound like now. Here they are at the Tiny Desk concert. This is Hanson on Central Time.